is the matter of Kathleen Fowler versus AT&T Inc. Mr. Farrell, you want to proceed?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Brian Farrell, counsel for appellant Kathleen Fowler. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The district court's decision granting summary judgment in favor of AT&T in this employment discrimination case should be reversed and remanded for three primary points. First, the district court overlooked Ms. Fowler's compelling evidence of pretext. This is a case where Ms. Fowler has proven that AT&T's stated reasons for the single most material fact, that is, why her employment was terminated, are false. It is the rare employment discrimination case where a plaintiff can successfully prove the employer's rationale to be false, and Ms. Fowler has done that here. Under the Supreme Court's decision,
stop. Let me stop you right there, Mr. Farrell, just for information purposes, if I may. So we understand what the case is. Do I understand correctly that what we are talking about are essentially five claims, that is, disparate treatment as to the first surplus under ADEA and ADA, and then disparate treatment as to the second surplus as to both ADEA and ADA, and then finally a failure to accommodate claim under ADA. Is that the entirety of the case as it was brought and argued in the district court?
Yes, Your Honor, with one addition. She also has state law claims under the New Jersey law.
The New Jersey law case. I left out the pendant state claim. Yeah.
But yes, that is correct in addition to those state law claims.
This is an unusual case in a sense because of the two surpluses here, which is a euphemism that I, in and of itself, I find a bit unusual to declare someone surplus, but in any event, I know what it means in the context of this case. But I'm having a difficult time, and I hope you can help me here, understand how the two surpluses relate, if they do. That is to say that the January surplus ultimately leads to Ms. Fowler securing a position. She was not terminated. Indeed, she was given a choice between two positions, and she elected to take the one which ultimately, in the so-called October surplus, resulted in her eventually conceding that she was not capable of the job, that it required a skill set that she did not possess. So to refine my question then is, why is this not over after the January surplus because of her election of a position and then her eventual admission that she couldn't do the job, fulfill the requirements of the position that she took in New Jersey following the October surplus?
Well, there are separate challenged adverse actions, Your Honor, in as much as Ms. Fowler must navigate through the McDonnell-Douglas test with respect to both surpluses. And there are different stated reasons for each decision. There are different ratings with respect to each decision. AT&T claims that they've conducted a four-part rating of Ms. Fowler as the first surplus, and they claim the same as the second surplus. So the court must analyze each surplus, each of those challenged adverse actions separately through McDonnell-Douglas to see whether or not Ms. Fowler can successfully navigate through as
the well. And the district court did analyze the first surplus, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor, the court analyzed both adverse actions.
Well, what about the numbers, if you will, with respect to the first surplus and the ADEA claim? How do you have an ADEA claim? Let's assume you get by the prima facie case stage and you have the company come forward with its legitimate non-discriminatory reason. How can she show pretext in an age case when so many people were retained in the course of that reduction in force who were around her age and even older?
Well, that issue, Your Honor, the issue you're discussing is a prima facie case issue. And the court has established a bright line standard for establishing what's called the inference of discrimination at the prima facie stage in a reduction in force case, which is a point we tried to emphasize in our briefing. That is, if she can point to employees that were retained that were outside of her protected class, or in the case of an age case, sufficiently younger, if she can point to just one employee like that, then the court, to be consistent with its holdings in the Anderson v. Conrail, Showalter versus University of Pitt, and Monaco versus Amgen cases, could find that that is sufficient to establish the fourth element of the prima facie case. And then the burden shifts, as Your Honor pointed out, the burden of production shifts to AT&T to articulate a reason. They articulate a reason that there are these four surplus ratings and that she was rated and she fell below the line in her particular affected work group. And then the burden shifts back to Ms. Fowler to show pretext with respect to that stated reason. And the pretext standard in this court was set forth in Fuentes. And Fuentes says that if Ms. Fowler can sufficiently discredit the reason by pointing to weaknesses, to pointing to contradictions or implausibilities in the stated reason, such that a reasonable fact finder could conclude that they are unworthy of credence, then she has demonstrated her under pretext.
How is the stated reason implausible when, as I indicated in my previous question, you have so many people who are retained in the course of a reduction in force, not a termination or an action of any kind that starts out as targeted to her?
Well, age discrimination can occur even if an employer does not fire other employees in the protected class. And the Supreme Court made that clear in the O'Connor versus Consolidated.
Well, we're not talking about firing, we're talking about retaining.
Well, again, Your Honor, that is a bright line standard as to the prima facie case. And once she can establish that, and again, this is a point that AT&T does not contest. They do not contest that Ms. Fowler was able to show that they retained similarly situated employees not of her protected class. And again, once she can do that, that ends the inquiry on that element. And then we move to the second step of McDonnell Douglas, and then we move to pretext. And to hold otherwise, Your Honor.
That's what I'm asking you about. I at the outset, I conceded, at least for argument's sake, the prima facie case. So how do we find pretext here? I'm only on the age piece now I'm asking about.
Well, it's because she has sufficiently discredited the surplus ratings that were assigned to her. She has pointed to sufficiently younger employees who received higher ratings than she did for no identifiable reason. We pointed to two comparators. We pointed to Mr. Garner and Mr. Howard, both of whom are sufficiently younger than Ms. Fowler.
So you're pointing to the January surplus. Isn't your much stronger argument the October surplus, where she's the only person?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that that is conclusive evidence of pretext. And
well, I don't know about conclusive. I mean, just saying, isn't your much stronger argument the October surplus situation?
Yes, I believe that that pretext argument is stronger than the January pretext argument. However, I still believe that our January surplus pretext argument is sufficient under Fuentes.
I can go back to January. You know, there were seven employees who were her age or older that were retained in the January surplus. So I have a real problem saying somehow that she has definitively shown that there was a pretext. But on October, the question is, when she's the only one, the problem is that one of the things you need in October is she has to be qualified for the new position. And it looks like there was a misgauging of the qualifications by her for this new position. Once upon a time, she had engineering skills, but life had changed a lot over the decade and a half. And it looked like she was rated at the very bottom of those who were being rated. And she, by her own admission, said she wasn't qualified. In fact, in one of the points during those few months, she said she wasn't qualified. So what is your argument that shows that there was a targeting because of her age or her disabilities? I can even add that on, but let's focus on age for the moment.
Well, the evidence is quite clear that she was pre-selected for surplus, that she was targeted.
But she was selected. I mean, it's sort of like the old GE model, but the lower 10% is not going to continue on the next year. Unfortunately, she's rated at the very bottom, the least qualified. And she admits that this new job just is not working. And so how do I possibly get around that?
Well, Your Honor, first, we dispute the notion that she was rated in accordance with the second surplus based upon Ms. Aruba's testimony, where Ms. Aruba said she did not conduct the surplus ratings of Ms. Fowler.
Do we know who did conduct the ratings for the second surplus?
Well, it's the answer to that question is no, Your Honor. And the second part of the answer to that question is we have proven with the documentary evidence that no surplus rating, no surplus assessment was made directly contrary to what AT&T has represented in this case, which again is this black and white distinction or this black and white contradiction that we've tried to emphasize in our briefing, that under...
Let me ask this, Mr. Hall, so that in terms of the memo she wrote basically saying that she couldn't do the job, this is as to the second surplus. Was that, and I probably should have read it more carefully, I initially thought that was more in terms of, look, I know N360, I'm used to N360, I need help to do this HALO, and it was more a request either for some kind of tutoring for the work on the HALO, or she did specifically ask for more time. She asked for 1.5 times the amount of time, which was deemed to be unreasonable, which may or may not be the case. But I thought that was the contract. So although you could clearly interpret it in the way that's being suggested, of her simply saying, I'm not qualified. But it seems to me it could go either way.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. And our position is that the statement that Ms. Fowler made in this email, where she says, I'm not qualified or not suited, it is not an admission that she does not meet the bare minimum requirement necessary to perform the job, which is what this court said in the Mackey case is the standard for determining objective qualification. And that evidence must be weighed against and viewed against what Ms. Aruba said regarding Ms. Fowler's qualifications at point of hire. That Ms. Aruba, who's the sole decision maker in that hiring decision, admits that Ms. Fowler is qualified for the job in every single respect. And again,
assume that gets her past the prima facie case stage. You're still left with her admission when the burden has shifted. And what should the court make of Ms. Fowler's own characterization as to her inability to do the job that she's now been given?
Well, that issue, Your Honor, AT&T has not argued that is a basis to support the surplus ratings. I mean, AT&T has failed to show that a single rating was done of Ms. Fowler in connection with the October 2016 surplus. And despite their own witness, the very person they identified as having done those ratings, despite her saying to me under oath, I didn't do the ratings, they have still clung to that reason in this litigation, that ratings occurred despite the person they identified saying that they didn't occur. That is pretext under Fuentes.
What does an employer do when an employee comes to her or him and flat out states, complains, I can't do this job?
Well,
do we still presume the person to be competent to do the job, to be more appropriately qualified to do the job?
Well, under the circumstances of this case, yes, Your Honor, because those statements by Ms. Fowler were made in the context of her requests for accommodations related to her health conditions, that they should not be viewed in isolation, in a vacuum. At the very same time she is saying these things to her, she's also asking for help related to her medical conditions.
And what accommodation did she ask for specifically? Did I know she made a request, or there was a request made for her that she needed half again the amount of time to do particular tasks. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
All right. What should we make of that?
Well, Your Honor, there were a number of requests that she made, including the one that we just discussed. She also, at the outset of her tenure, she asked for more time in general. And she also asked to be made releasable, simply that she could apply for another position. That request was denied for a period of about 2.5 months. But the key issue as to the request for accommodations, as it is with most failure to accommodate claims, is the interactive process and whether or not Ms. Fowler has demonstrated that that's a tribal issue of fact, which we believe she has, because we believe there's ample evidence of a breakdown in the interactive process on behalf of AT&T. The court in Taylor said that reviewing courts must assign blame or must look to assign blame for a breakdown in the interactive process. We believe we've provided ample evidence that the breakdown in the interactive process occurred and it was the fault of AT&T.
Maybe you help me understand, what is this coaching action plan that Aruva recommended that she undergo? And apparently there's some issue about whether or not the very existence of a CAP, as it's called, is contrary to AT&T policies. I don't understand that.
Your Honor, AT&T has a very clear progressive disciplinary policy, and there are multiple steps, as there are with most employers, progressive disciplinary policies. And the first step requires an informal dialogue between AT&T and the employee for a period of 2 weeks to discuss general performance deficiencies. How are you going to get better? That's step one, and that's in the record. Step two is the coaching action plan, which Ms. Aruva put her on. And step three is a performance improvement plan. We've shown that Ms. Aruva skipped step one, essentially, and she went straight to the coaching action plan, which we believe is also evidence in favor of supporting our pretext argument. But there's no dispute, and she admitted, in fact, skipping the first step of this progressive disciplinary process. One other point I'd like to make on this issue, Your Honor, is Ms. Aruva testified definitively that she made a deliberate decision not to put Ms. Fowler on a performance improvement plan after the coaching action plan because of Ms. Fowler's noted improvement on the job. And that as of June 1st, 2016, a month after she sends this email saying I'm not qualified or suited, Ms. Aruva tells Ms. Fowler that she's doing fine in the job. And then as of September 14th, 2016, which is the date they pre-select Ms. Fowler for the second surplus, Ms. Aruva admits to me under oath that Kathleen Fowler is performing all of her job duties to a satisfactory degree. So that despite whatever Ms. Fowler thought or believed about her qualifications at the time she made those communications, her own performance on the job proved that she was in fact qualified to do it.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Furrell before we have him back on rebuttal? Because I know we're going to be hearing from the amicus next.
I'll wait till rebuttal if I have any questions.
Oh, all right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Furrell. We'll have you back on rebuttal. Mr. Horowitz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jeremy Horowitz with the EEOC.
Let me just start out with a softball, I guess, and that is, if an employee is surplused or declared surplus, in given the meaning that we have here in AT&T's plan to reduce force, how is that not effectively a bullseye on the back of an employee, which changes the terms and conditions of employment? The employer may not hit the bullseye and the employee stays, but then again, the employee has been put into a particular class, the surplus, where there is now a risk, if you will, a possibility that the person will lose her job.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. I mean, in this case,
I was really hoping you would challenge me and disagree with me on that point.
Really, that when she's being placed on the surplus and when she's told that she will be terminated and she'll be terminated if she's unable to find another job, yeah, that is an adverse employment action for two reasons. It's both an adverse employment action because it's essentially a termination. I mean, it's a notice of termination. And it's also, even after she's able to find the alternative job, it's an adverse employment action because it's a change in the terms and conditions of her employment. So that's exactly right.
Even including lateral transfers within the company.
Even including lateral transfers, exactly, Your Honor. And that's based on the language of the statute. The statutes involved, Title VII, both the statutes involved here, the ADA and the Age Act, say that a change in the terms and conditions of employment is included. A discriminatory change in terms and conditions of employment is included. There's no statutory language in there that requires anything additional to that. As the Supreme Court has held in a number of cases, when the term is not otherwise defined in the statute, you apply the ordinary meaning. And the ordinary meaning of terms and conditions clearly includes within it the transfer of job duties. So in that case, it clearly falls within the statute. As the Supreme Court also said in Meritor, this phrase, terms, conditions, privileges of employment, it's supposed to get at the entire spectrum of discriminatory treatment, not just a narrowly looking at economic or contractual differentiation. And this was a point that a number of judges have come to recently, including now Justice Kavanaugh and the Ortiz-Diaz decision that we saw. It's also a position that the United States government has taken in a number of recent filings with the Supreme Court and with a number of other courts of appeals. The position is also fully consistent with our regulations, which were adopted pursuant to notice and comment at the direction of Congress and are therefore entitled to substantial deference under Chevron. I'm not sure if Your Honors would like me to continue discussing that or if I should talk more about the idea of this future notice of termination constituting an adverse employment action.
Well, since you only have a little more than a minute left, we leave that choice to you.
All right, I appreciate that, Your Honor. Let me just say, with respect to the district court applying Langley is not good law on this issue because it's not a published decision and therefore has no precedential value, but also because it attempts to import additional language into the statute that's just not there when it requires that the position into which somebody is transferred be inferior in some objective way. The language of the statute has no such inferiority requirement. And as the Supreme Court has said, when language is not found in the statute, judges should not read that language into the statute. Just very briefly, with respect to the notice of future termination, that is something that both Ricks and Watson hold is an adverse employment action. And in Watson, that was even when, like this case, there was a possibility left open of finding an alternative position. The court still found that it was an adverse employment action.
Couldn't that have a perverse effect only of rewarding discriminatory bosses who, for strategy reasons, want to transfer certain employees out of their own backyard? In other words, the consequences could be, in some cases, not so good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, that's why the transfers are included within this language of terms and conditions of employment. It's not just whether you're making the same amount of money. I mean, it is, if an employee says that this is not something I want, that this is discriminatory and it's changing my terms and conditions of employment, that's enough to satisfy the statute.
But could it also, now let's flip it around, could it work the other way, that it will discourage bosses from trying to find lateral positions for their employees?
Well, no, Your Honor, if it's not a discriminatory means of changing terms and conditions, if the employee, I mean, certainly if the employee is offered the transfer and accepts it, then there's not a problem. But if the transfer is imposed upon the employee for discriminatory reasons, then yes, that would still fall under the statute.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horwitz.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And we'll call upon Mr. Gage for the defendant appellee.
May it please the court, I'm Ken Gage and on behalf of AT&T. Your Honors, I will start where we just finished since it's all fresh in everyone's mind, and that is the issue that the EEOC is here for today. This case does not present what I will characterize as an interesting academic question. Both the cases cited by EEOC and this record illustrate why this is not the right case for Your Honors to wrestle with that interesting academic question, really for two reasons. One, EEOC relies heavily on a series of timeliness cases. The fact that the Supreme Court and this court have held that someone needs to act within the 300 days required by the statute after they are given notice that they are losing their job does not translate into, in all factual circumstances, the conclusion that every time that happens, an adverse action results. And here, it didn't result. And in all of those timeliness cases cited by the EEOC, it did result. Second, two of the cases referenced by the EEOC, two out of the DC Circuit. Again, they're very interesting cases, Ortiz-Diaz and the Chambers case cited in the letter recently submitted by EEOC. They illustrate why this is not the right case. In one of them, Ortiz-Diaz, the district court granted summary judgment. The panel affirmed. The panel sua sponte reconsidered its decision and reversed. In Chambers, summary judgment was granted to the employer, and the DC Circuit affirmed summary judgment there because the plaintiff had not come forward with sufficient evidence to show that there was an adverse employment action. It is well established under the McDonnell-Douglas test. That is a prong of the test. You have to show an adverse employment action. And here we think Judge Shipp got it right. There's no evidence in the record, show that this lateral position that Ms. Fowler moved into materially disadvantaged her in any way. She chose it. AT&T offered her two positions and she chose this of two of them. So we don't think Your Honors even need to address that question. Ms. Fowler's appeal has
She chose the wrong one. I mean, it may be for a couple of reasons she didn't want to move to Texas, but you know, for her doctors were in Jersey and also her home was in Jersey, but perhaps in hindsight, she should have chosen Texas. The point being here is that you're putting it, when you are taking, as I understand the EEOC position, when you are taking somebody out of their job, think of that as, deem that to be an adverse employment action because you don't know what's going to happen. And it is one, you're not going to be in the job that you previously had. So what's wrong with the simplicity of that argument?
Nothing, Your Honor. I would say that that means that there is potentially an adverse employment action. And I'll give you some hypotheticals. One of which is someone is designated for surplus. And the next week, one of their coworkers dies. And the employee no longer has to lose their job because they have fewer people to do the work. Another example is the Schultz case cited by the EEOC.
That doesn't prevent the initial decision from being an adverse employment action. It's just that the adversity was mitigated by subsequent events.
It was canceled out.
I respectfully disagree. Your Honor, the surplus here, she was told that in the future, she would lose her job. We have to wait for the future to play out to find out whether she loses her job. And in my hypothetical, the person never lost their job. And my point here is, again, there is extensive law from this court and other courts that a plaintiff has to show an adverse employment action. In Ortiz-Diaz, we can see how the Court of Appeals struggled with the question. And there was evidence, two significant forms of evidence. One, the plaintiff's, that was a denial of transfer case. The plaintiff's existing supervisor had behaved in a racist fashion. and was allegedly creating a hostile work environment. There was evidence
That is far from our case, Mr. Gage, and I'm wrestling with how it cannot be adverse when a person is placed into a pool and notified of that their job is effectively no longer secure. That is to say that there is now a possibility that we can't quantify at this point, but a possibility that they will lose that job. Why is that not adverse?
Your Honor, I think that is potentially adverse, and we have to wait for the facts to play out to find out whether that adversity
So your position is the adverse nature of any kind of employment action or decision is based upon the ultimate result. It cannot be in the initial determination to place a person in this pool of surplus.
Your Honor, I think the question around the initial determination is whether it is motivated by a protected characteristic, whether the result of that determination is adversely impacts the person, depends upon the facts. And in my hypothetical, if someone is told you are being surplused and the next day the company decides because someone died on the team, they no longer need to eliminate that person's job, Your Honor, we submit that should not be actionable under the statutes.
But the EEOC is focusing on the terms of the statute, where it says, and it seems to be plausible because the statutes prohibit discrimination, not just in termination, but also in, quote, terms, conditions, and privileges of employment, close quote. That's 42 USC 1211A. And 29 USC 623A1. How do I get around the text?
Your Honor, we believe that simply telling someone that their job may go away in the future should not be actionable as a change in the conditions or terms of their employment, unless it actually happens and those terms and conditions do change in the future. The conversation in which someone is told this may happen in the future, a conversation we submit is not a change in the terms and conditions of the employee's employment. But Your Honors, we don't think you even need to get to this because the plaintiff concedes in her brief that she needs to show that the termination occurred under circumstances giving rise to an inference of discrimination. And it simply did not here. And I'd like to address a few of what we think are baseless claims by Ms. Fowler that AT&T misrepresented the facts or lied about the surplus selection or misrepresented the identity of the decision maker. Excuse me. First, contrary to Ms. Fowler's argument, there is no genuine issue regarding the elimination of the 17 positions in the first surplus.
But didn't Ms. Fowler say that her job was, that Fowler's job was not actually eliminated?
She did not, Your Honor. Ms. De La Cruz's testimony, in that part of her deposition, she was simply talking about how she was going to be reallocating resources among the remaining members of the team. The evidence that we put forth in the record shows undeniably that 17 jobs were eliminated. And Ms. De La Cruz's testimony about how they were going to do the work going forward and reallocating responsibilities does not contradict that. It certainly doesn't create any genuine issue as to that, Your Honor. Similarly, Ms. Eastwood's testimony about the ratings. Ms. Fowler contends that simply because 3 years later she couldn't remember the specific reasons justifying her contemporaneously recorded ratings of her team, that creates an issue of fact. And we submit it does not. Because if you look at that testimony, you can see that whenever she was asked why she didn't know, she said she couldn't remember. And a witness's failed memory hardly creates a question of fact around contemporaneously recorded ratings.
But if that's the case, then, because these suits will always come to the deposition or to a trial at some period of time after the event. So all the employer has to do is say, I don't remember why I did that. I don't remember. And the fact finder cannot read anything into the fact that the failed memory may be a suggestion that the ratings were not based upon a good faith evaluation of the employee.
Your Honor, I think in Fuentes, this court specifically said the fact that someone doesn't remember those kinds of specifics does not create a genuine issue of fact. And if you look at Ms. Eastwood's testimony, she was being asked 3 years later what the reasons were for particular ratings on different categories for many people. The fact that she doesn't remember those particulars and the fact that when asked why she couldn't remember them, she simply said, I can't remember that. That does not create, certainly is not sufficient evidence to give rise to inference of discrimination. Next, Ms. Fowler argues that she was somehow targeted. Now, first of all, there's nothing in the record whatsoever to suggest that she was targeted, if you will, because of any protected characteristic. First, the surplus guidelines in the record, appendix page 822, in the surplus guidelines under the heading determined scope of initiative, the following question is posed, quote, will the effort target specific levels, titles, functions, locations, or other segments of the organizations? So the use of that word should not suggest any inference of discrimination. Second, the fact that leadership in the organization was evaluating how it would get necessary work done with fewer people, and they discussed critically what work could be reduced. And the testimony is clear, both from Ms. Aruva and Mr. Morella, that the ND360 work and the ABM work was minimal work. There wasn't much of it. It was declining. And therefore, it was something they could get rid of. And Ms. Fowler was the one that was doing that. And so that does not give rise to an inference that they were picking her because of her age or a disability. Next, as Your Honors have pointed out, and generally, all of the evidence shows that Ms. Fowler practically shouted from the rooftops to her boss, her boss's boss, and her boss's boss's boss from the day after she started in this job that she didn't want the job and that she couldn't do the job. Finally, HR stepped in and said, you need to rate these people. You need to put all of these people together in an affected work group and rate them. So now let's talk about the ratings. Ms. Aruva undeniably did those ratings. She undeniably did those. When she was asked in her deposition, she was shown an exhibit. You can see it referenced in the record, P35. She was shown an exhibit. She said those were hers. She did them. She also said they were from the MESA system. What's the MESA system? The MESA system is the Mechanized Employee Surplus Administration system, which Ms. Fowler's counsel knows full well is the system used for the surplus. Then Ms. Fowler's counsel asked Ms. Aruva a leading question, quote, and the system you're referring to is Amplify? Ms. Aruva's response, in 2016, we were using MESA. So it is undisputed, it is undeniable. And the ratings that we submitted that supported the summary judgment motion are attributed to Ms. Aruva. She was unclear in her deposition testimony as to what they were, whether they were mid-year or annual. And that's what she said. So it is disingenuous for Ms. Fowler to somehow say that she wasn't the rater. And indeed today, Mr. Farrell specifically characterized Ms. Aruva as the sole decision maker. Now, let's briefly talk about Ms. Fowler's performance as the senior systems engineer. She refused to do much of the work. She wouldn't do HALO. She only did certain types of work. The evidence undeniably shows that Ms. Aruva was patient. She got her assistance. She was not disciplining her. The CAP was a plan to help her get up to speed. But it is undisputed that the rest of the people on Ms. Aruva's team were spending 90 to 100% of their time on HALO projects. And that's at pages 496 and 497. So
after CAP, how much time was she spending on HALO?
According to Ms. Aruva's testimony, I believe she said it was probably 5 to 10 hours a week of work.
After the CAP?
Your Honor, I don't think the testimony is specific to that time frame, but it was that she was doing about 5 to 10 hours worth of work, and that was the estimate of about how much of that work actually existed. So I'd like to briefly address, Your Honors, the failure to accommodate claim two. AT&T undisputedly engaged in good faith. In the interactive process. Ms. Fowler and her doctors undisputedly were responsible for significant delays. As of August 10th, nearly 3 months after Ms. Fowler was first told, someone suggested to her, go to the Integrated Disability Service Center with your health issues. 3 months later, one of her doctors said he had nothing to offer in terms of specifics of an accommodation. And it was only later that her other doctor said, give her 1.5, 1.5 the amount of time to do the work. And admittedly, the IDSC said that generally we can't lower expectations. So can you give us more? They asked for more information from her doctor. They came back with nothing. And again, it's undisputed that Ms. Fowler was given plenty of time to do her work. They gave her less work. So this case is very similar, Your Honors, I would say, to the Sessoms case, Sessoms versus Trustees of the University of Pennsylvania. There, the plaintiff suffered mental and physical disabilities. She had performance issues. She attributed those to her disabilities, including memory loss, like Ms. Fowler. Ms. Sessoms' supervisor was less sympathetic than Ms. Fowler's supervisor. She even said, as that decision shows, that told Ms. Sessoms that her medical issues were irrelevant and she didn't care about them. Ms. Sessoms clearly wanted another job. She, at her doctor's suggestions, asked for an accommodation. The company gave her part-time work. They helped her, but they said they wouldn't give her another job. Summary judgment was granted and this court affirmed.
Unless your honors have any- Can I go back to the issue of adverse employment action. The Supreme Court in Ricks, which was a case from the Third Circuit, said that telling somebody that they were going to be terminated within a year, the statute began the day you got the notice. We followed suit in Watson in 2000, saying that if somebody at Kodak was allowed to remain beyond a particular date, only if he was successful in obtaining another position, the statute of limitations began when you got the notice. It would seem that you, if we follow what you're suggesting, under Ricks and Watson, you could have somebody not have a substantive action until after the statute of limitations had expired. And then why don't we just extend Ricks and the Watson case, similar to what the DC Circuit's done in Singletary and the Second Circuit's done in Schultz?
Well, Your Honor, first, I guess I would say in the Schultz case, the Second Circuit very clearly said that that decision was limited to the facts in that case. There it was, and also procedurally, it was a different posture. That was a Rule 12b6 motion.
Let's forget Singletary and Schultz for the second. Let's go back. What about the consequences of following your path in light of Ricks and Watson, that a statute of limitations begins the day you're given the notice that you could potentially be terminated?
Well, Your Honor, I think that we're not asking this court to change that rule. You are told you are being fired. The clock starts running on your 300 days. We don't dispute that. Does it present a problematic circumstance for someone who's told you're going to be terminated 310 days from now, whether they file a charge? I think under those facts, they have to talk to their lawyer. I would advise them to file a charge, given Ricks. But I don't think this case, the facts in this case, present Your Honors with the opportunity to wrestle with this specific issue, because Ms. Fowler looked for a job, she found two jobs, and she picked one of them. And her pay didn't change, her benefits didn't change, And she didn't present evidence in the record that there was any adverse consequence to her by taking this job. And we submit that on summary judgment, it is her burden to do that.
So what you're suggesting is that in this type of situation, this sticky situation, we just wait till there's somebody that goes to 310 days and we deal with it then. But what's the problem with dealing with it now?
If your honors choose to address the question, there is nothing wrong with your honors addressing it now. I just think that Judge Shipp's decision was supported by this record. I candidly agree. This is an interesting academic question that is more starkly presented in the transfer and refusal to transfer context, but that's similar to this. And the courts that have wrestled with that, including the DC Circuit in Ortiz-Diaz and in Chambers, they look for that evidence. And again, in Chambers, summary judgment was affirmed by the DC Circuit.
Respectfully, in the employment setting, I really think that this is more than an academic exercise, since it involves someone's job and at least the probability of someone's retaining that job over the longer term. But academic, practical, or both, the panel will wrestle with it. And we've extended both sides more than the time they've been allotted, but there is rebuttal that Mr. Farrell has requested. So we'll turn the matter over to Mr. Farrell to present his rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, everyone, for your time today. I want to start by addressing the issue of Ms. Aruba's testimony that Mr. Gage claims it's undisputed that her testimony, that she was mistaken and that she was really referring to surplus assessments, not end of year ratings. That's simply untrue. It's untrue based on the clarity of her testimony. But the more important point is that this court cannot come to the determination that Ms. Aruba made a mistake based upon the clarity of her testimony in her saying, I didn't do the surplus assessments. That is a jury question. The jury should be able to decide whether or not she did make a mistake. And if she testifies at trial that, now, you know what, these were actually the surplus ratings, well, then she's going to be impeached by her own sworn testimony in which she said, and I quote, do you see how Fowler requests information used for surplus? Yes. Do you see how she makes that request? No. Did you provide her that information? No. Why not? I'm not the one who did the assessment to include her. Do you know who is? I don't know. Her testimony could not be clearer. The court cannot conclude under Rule 56 that it was a mistake. And one final point on this issue, Ms. Aruba submitted an errata sheet following her deposition. It is in the record at Appendix 2380 to 2382. She corrected a number of mistakes in her testimony. She did not correct this testimony. Very briefly on the issue of targeting, I direct your honor's attention to the testimony of the 30B6 witness, the very witness that AT&T designated to testify about the surplus guidelines. I cited it verbatim in the reply brief. She quite simply and clearly says she's never heard of the term target employee. A pre-selection, a preliminary identification of employee violates the guidelines, not only the guidelines, but also the code of conduct. And I also direct your honor's attention to the testimony of the other human resources business partner in this case, a woman named Terry McGovern, who was responsible for the HR functions related to the second surplus. She was so taken aback by this issue about targeting that she testified she would have slapped Mr. Ty Rollins had she known that he was pre-selecting employees. It is a disturbing procedural violation that they cannot get around at summary judgment.
If we hold that Ms. Fowler was not qualified for her new position, doesn't that bar her failure to accommodate claim as a matter of law?
Well, it depends on what aspect of the qualification analysis Your Honor is referring to under McDonnell Douglas, because under the ADA, it is a two-part test. She must show objective qualification, and then she must show that she was otherwise qualified to perform the essential functions of the job with or without accommodation at the time of the challenged adverse employment action. That's the second component. And the second component of that analysis requires the court to analyze the failure to accommodate claim. Because if the court concludes that Ms. Fowler presented a triable issue of fact as to the failure to accommodate claim, then she is qualified for purposes of the McDonnell-Douglas test because she is an individual who can perform the functions with accommodation.
All right, thank you. We're well beyond the time allotted for rebuttal, but we thank all of counsel, Mr. Farrell, Mr. Gage, and Mr. Horowitz on behalf of the EEOC. The panel will take the matter under advisement, and I will ask Mr. Kane to adjourn the proceeding.